This week on the Back Table Podcast.
I think that patients are getting more sophisticated. The prepared patient is the best patient, and best, I mean, from their overall own well-being. They've heard it before. It's not a surprise. They're potentially prepared for it. It takes a lot less time doing it up front than trying to explain it after the fact. So all of those things, prepping patients for what the potential outcomes are, it takes a few minutes, it's time well spent, and you'll have a much happier patient population.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Back Table Podcast, your source for all things urology. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and at backtable.com. Now, a quick word from our sponsor. This discussion is brought to you by Veracyt, provider of the Decipher Prostate Genomic Classifier. Decipher Prostate is a test for patients with localized prostate cancer that can help personalize treatment. Every patient and their prostate cancer is unique, and Decipher Prostate can provide meaningful insight into the aggressiveness of each individual's patient's tumor. Because the Decipher score is derived solely from the genomic characteristics of the tumor, it provides information not available through already known clinical and pathologic factors. Decipher high-risk patients generally benefit from earlier or intensified treatment, while Decipher low-risk patients may be ideal candidates for monitoring or less overall treatment. Decipher Prostate is the most validated gene expression test in localized prostate cancer, with level 1 evidence in national clinical practice guidelines and more than 70 peer-reviewed publications, including more than 65,000 patients. Visit veracyt.com/decipher to learn more. Now, back to the show. This is Aditya Bagrodia as your host this week, and I'm very excited to introduce our guest today, James Eastham, who's Chief of Urology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and the Peter Scardino Chair in Urology. James, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Thanks for having me. Hope you're well too.
Yeah, things are great. This is really one that I've been looking forward to. I had the good fortune of training under Dr. Eastham, James Eastham, who's really been a force in the field of prostate cancer, tremendous surgeon, tremendous clinician, and really looking forward to kind of picking your brain on biochemical recurrence. This is obviously something that's challenging for patients, it's challenging for providers, and really just kind of want to walk through your whole thought process. And I thought we could actually kick off with the preoperative counseling. When you see a patient that comes in, their cancer merits treatment, and you're advising them, let's focus on the kind of oncologic outcomes. What does that look like, James?
So it is changing, and it has changed over the years. We've transitioned from operating on folks who had relatively low or favorable intermediate risk, and now we're operating on patients with much higher risk cancers. And so the need for salvage treatment or even adjuvant treatment has increased. So I have a conversation based on the patient's risk, first letting them know that if they do require treatment after surgery, it's not necessarily a failure. It's part of their treatment paradigm. And especially in high-risk situations, in many other cancers, we routinely use combinations of surgery and radiation therapy. So I approach it that way, that surgery is potentially curative, but it's also potentially part of a multi-dimensional strategy that may involve radiation, that may involve systemic therapy, and we will go through the process of how those might be incorporated.
Yeah, that's super helpful. And are you actually going through the Sloan Kettering nomograms, the Parton tables, any type of predictive model with their specific characteristics? Or is it a gestalt after doing this for a while?
Yeah, it's a gestalt. I mean, I do not give a patient, you have an X percent chance of biochemical recurrence within so many months of surgery. I just give them a gestalt that patients with your risk prostate cancer are more or less likely, or there is a chance that you will need additional treatment down the road. Most of that will be guided by your postoperative PSA testing. Pathology can help guide the type of treatment, but whether or not treatment is given is usually determined by whether or not their PSA is detectable and rising.
Perfect, perfect. And I think you're absolutely right. These days, it's not grade group one or even small volume grade group two with a small pattern four. These are real cancers. And we have so many more tools now, MRI and PSMA PET scan, and maybe we'll touch base on that. I would say, like, I also go with the Gestalt. Early on, I used the Sloan Kettering nomograms, but I feel like they can be a little bit of a source of consternation for patients. When you look at these biochemical recurrence-free survival rates, that can be relatively low. And even when you shift to your overall survival at 10 and 15 years being 99%, 99% respectively, on the one hand, I think it manages expectations. On the other hand, I think it can be a little bit dejecting out of the gates. Any comment on that?
Yeah, I think like anything, we have a nomogram's a tool, and not all tools need to be utilized. Many of our patients will have gone on the website, and the nomograms are available. And if they're interested in chatting about that, that's fine. I'll go through what they mean and what they don't mean, that biochemical recurrence is not death, that it oftentimes initiates an evaluation and potentially treatment, but surgery is still a very effective part of the management strategy, hopefully the only management strategy, but part of the management strategy for many patients with higher risk disease. And we don't know whether surgery upfront or typically in the higher risk setting, radiation plus hormones upfront is the best course. So it's a discussion with the patient about which of those strategies might be best for them. I do not believe that surgery should be used in every single patient, and I don't believe radiation therapy is appropriate for every single patient. And it is getting a sense of what the patient is interested in accomplishing, what they're trying to do. Those types of factors come into what is recommended for a given patient. So it's not one size fit all, and it's utilizing the tools we have. Hopefully we don't need all of the tools, but in a given patient, utilizing as few as of the tools that we have to try to get them to where they want to be. And that can vary from patient to patient.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. As a part of the counseling, I try to get a sense of, does this patient prefer things to be a little bit more black and white, PSA detectable, undetectable? If that resonates with a given person and they're a good candidate for both, sometimes I feel like that could be reason enough to tip them in one way or the other. I also think it'll be exciting to see the output of the Scandinavian trial, which is a difficult trial to execute, of surgery and possible postoperative radiation versus upfront radiation. It's been in the works for, gosh, 10, 15 years now. Any thoughts on that, James, how that's going to enlighten us?
It'll be like any clinical trial in non-metastatic prostate cancer. To get a meaningful endpoint will take a decade, unless you select really, really high-risk patients, and then you'll get an outcome a little sooner. But for most patients, it's always going to be, we don't know the exact right strategy. And for you, these are the things you'll have to weigh. And I very frequently say, and I just was in clinic and I was chatting with a gentleman with unfavorable intermediate risk prostate cancer. And I said, you know, I could have your prostate twin sitting next to you, give you both the exact same information. One of you may opt for a radiation-based strategy. The other may opt for a surgery-based strategy. And you're both right, because there will be something about a treatment that is either appealing or so unappealing that you'll go with the direction that it guides you to. And that's the state right now. We've done lots of randomized trials, and we say, yes, that was a good randomized trial, and we still don't follow the results. We still don't let it guide treatment. So I'm not sure a randomized trial will convince the biased to change what they do. But it's good to get information. Hopefully the trials will be successful. And ultimately, we're trying to improve how we take care of our patients.
Perfect, perfect. Well, let's get on into the nuts and bolts. First, postoperative PSA, when is that coming typically?
So you mean in terms of testing or what value or both?
Yeah, so timing, what test, and what value? How about all three?
Sure. I mean, and again, there's no science, it's preference. I usually get a PSA at about 6 to 8 weeks after surgery. usually get one at 6 months after surgery, and then every 6 months. If they were a pathologically confined Gleason 3+4=7, at 3 years, I'll convert to just checking a PSA once a year. If they were at higher risk than that, I'll continue doing PSAs every 6 months for the first 5 years. That is purely Eastham's brain. No science behind that. It's just what I prefer. So there's no rationale for that, but that's just what I do. The PSAs, what triggers salvage treatment has changed. Certainly in my career, it used to be that as soon as the PSA became detectable and it was confirmed that it was rising, and this was with ultrasensitive values, at least at Memorial, it's down around 0.05. When it reached 0.06 and it was confirmed, we would very frequently send to radiation therapy at that point. Then the whole concept of, well, maybe there's a benign component, we should probably wait a little bit longer. Then it became, okay, we'll call a recurrence at 0.1. And then we would send to radiation therapy. And then now with PSMA scanning and the 0.2 cutoff, it's typically I'm waiting now until the PSA gets to 0.2, except in selected patients. Obviously, if they had positive lymph nodes, a large positive margin that was more than a couple millimeters, then I'll send early. But for the majority of patients, typically waiting until their PSA is 0.2 would do imaging with both an MRI and a PSMA PET scan at that point and refer typically to radiation oncology, letting the patient know that even in the setting of negative imaging, we likely will still recommend treatment, usually radiation therapy to the prostatic fossa.
Okay, so I'm going to make sure. So largely that sounds very similar to the way I practice, not surprising since Memorial is where I train. So I generally don't get the, I guess I'll call it ultra PSAs less than 0.006.
No, I don't get those either. It's 0.05 at Memorial, so.
Okay, yeah, I generally find that they cause consternation. We'll talk a little bit about convalescence, timing, and how all that kind of plays in. 6 to 8 weeks is exactly what I do, especially in the high-risk patients. And it's more to be a conversation starter necessarily than to pull the trigger, at least the way I kind of think about it. So we talk about timing, ultrasensitive, and then value. So for you, high-risk patient, multifocal positive nodes, node-positive disease, detectable has got your attention. Garden variety, things are still not entirely clear. You're monitoring that. And 0.1, 0.2 is kind of your threshold for defining a biochemical recurrence.
Correct. Yeah, I think most the radiation therapy trials that looked at adjuvant versus early salvage, they didn't focus on node positive patients. And I think we can't apply a weight for the salvage setting in the node positive patient. So I think node positive is a different risk category. And I have a low threshold to send node positive patients to radiation oncology. Now it's also, and I'm telling someone who knows, but node positive patients aren't all the same. There's a risk of recurrence or a spectrum of recurrence even within node positive. I mean, a patient who had a 3+4=7 confined to the prostate with a solitary positive lymph node is very different than someone with a Gleason 9 with 6 positive nodes, extraprostatic extension and seminal vesicle invasion. Those patients are both node positive, but they're going to have a very different likelihood of recurrence. I mean, half of the former, the lower risk node positive, won't ever experience BCR, whereas I would venture to say 99.9% of the high risk patients will. So it's difficult to talk in generalities about, oh, salvage radiation. It still becomes risk adjusted. So it is, while we tend not to think about adjuvant radiation therapy per se, I think in the node positive, very high risk group, I talk to those patients when I discuss their pathology that you're likely going to need radiation therapy and we may not wait until your PSA reaches 0.2. We'll have you heal up from the operation, get your continence back, but I'm going to have you meet with a radiation oncologist sooner rather than later, so that's all in place. Whereas someone who had a regular non-node positive radical prostatectomy with modest risk of recurrence, I won't send them to radiation therapy. I'll monitor their PSA test.
Yeah, I think it actually is a fairly common theme in prostate cancer. It's either very little monitoring or it's kitchen sink. And I hear you, you know, a 52-year-old with T3B, grade group 5, 1, maybe even 2 out of 20 nodes positive. I'm worried that might be a radiation Abbey and ADT patient, whereas the first patient you described, 3 plus 4 equals 7, maybe a T3A, negative node, negative margins, positive single node, good lymph node density. Perhaps we just monitor that. And I do think it's shared decision making. Here's your risk of recurrence. Here's what post-operative treatment, systemic therapy, radiation looks like. Fantastic. So, you know, I also get MRIs and PSMA PET scans in the biochemical recurrent setting just to kind of get an updated lay of the land. And actually, one of the radoncs asked me, why do I get MRIs? And I'd be curious from your perspective, and are you doing rectal exams as well, how that influences what comes next?
So I don't frequently do rectal examinations solely because many of my patients, I'm on the computer screen with them. I'm, you know, it's a telemedicine chat. Not many folks we operate on aren't, you know, even Jersey is considered a long way away from Manhattan. So we do a lot of this by phone, by telemedicine. They're not in person. And in reality, whether I feel a little bit of something or don't feel a little bit of something, I think our imaging is so much better these days that if we don't do routine post-operative digital rectal examinations, I think it's okay, especially if the PSA is undetectable. So sure. The reason I still use MRI is because on some of the PET scanning, the bladder can be full of tracer. And it, if there's a small area of abnormality within the prostatic fossa, it may simply be missed, which I've seen. And not all cancers, recurrent cancers in this case, are PSMA avid. So I think they're complementary imaging studies. And with radiation therapy today, sometimes I use MRI guidance. So if there's something one can see on an MRI, I think it provides information in terms of, is there a recurrence or not? I think the MRI shows the area of the anastomosis better than what a PSMA PET scan does. So I think both imaging studies are complementary. I use the MRI for local evaluation. I use the PSMA more for, you'll get some local information, but more for distant disease, nodal, et cetera.
Yeah, that's way more sophisticated than my answer, which is if I'm going to go in and do any type of salvage treatment after primary treatment to the prostate, I want to know what the anatomy's like. And I would imagine that the radiation oncologist or an astute radiation oncologist can derive something beneficial.
I think you just insulted your radiation oncologist by saying he's not astute.
No, well, that fair. They're excellent. That wasn't
no,
the point.
I was just joking, of course.
Okay, so very good. And you kind of touch base on, you know, when you refer to radonc, the kind of higher risk patient. Can you tell me a little bit about how you think about a persistently detectable PSA? We'll talk about a biochemical recurrence, but that's obviously overall disappointing for the patient, disappointing for us as their surgeon. What does that kind of counseling session look like?
Yeah, obviously it's very disappointing for the patient and their family, of course. I mean, as a surgeon, we want to cure everybody, but that's unfortunately not reality. And it typically represents metastatic disease. I mean, unless the surgeon grossly left behind tumor, which is infrequent these days. I mean, with imaging technology, you know, the robots and all of that good stuff, we can see a lot better than what we could many years ago. So I think leaving gross tumor behind is rare. So I think if surgery fails, it's typically related to, meaning fails immediately, it's typically related to undiagnosed metastatic disease. And that is becoming less frequent because we're now using better preoperative imaging to help assess extent of disease. So with PSMA, we're finding lymph nodes in areas where we wouldn't even think, I mean, mesorectal nodes, you find them in all sorts of locations that we wouldn't typically even think to look, that are now showing up on these scans. So I think imaging will help because it'll help guide how we initially counsel and manage the patients. So we should have fewer of these persistently detectable PSAs after surgery, but I think it tends to represent metastatic disease, so it will be systemic therapy, plus if we see an area of abnormality, likely radiation therapy to that site as well.
Perfect. That sounds very consistent with what I've found kind of anecdotally. It would be a patient that really probably didn't meet criteria to get staged with a PSMA PET scan. The pathology was a bit more ominous on final prostatectomy, and their 6-8 week PSA is a little bit higher. Real quick, when you're staging broad strokes, who are you getting PSMA PET scans in versus is the MRI sufficient? Can you just talk a little bit on pre-op staging?
Yeah. I mean, typically if they're high risk, PSA is over 20, Gleason 8 or higher, bulky disease on an MRI even, all have a low threshold to try to get a PSMA scan. Now, they're not always paid for. And so then the dilemma is, will the patient cover the costs out of pocket, or will we just do without a PSMA scan? But certainly in the high-risk setting, we've been fairly successful to get PSMAs covered. The question then is, well, what about unfavorable intermediate-risk disease? And it tends to be on the unfavorable side, 90% pattern 4 plus 3, that's 90% pattern 4, compared to 55% pattern 4 and 1 biopsy. Higher volume Gleason 4 disease, basically, higher PSAs. Favorable intermediate risk, don't do it. Certainly in low-risk patients, don't do anything. But high-risk patients and selected unfavorable intermediate-risk patients for PSMA scanning.
Perfect. Exactly. Kind of consistent with what we do. Well, we'll actually talk in, I promise, we're going to get to biochemical recurrence, but I typically will tell patients, even when they're high risk, that have, you know, met with our multi-D folks and they've elected for surgery, that if anything's going to be required, and it's a little bit of an exaggeration, that nearly certainly we won't be doing anything for 6 months. And obviously, if they're continent and potent 10 days after their catheter comes out, that's wonderful for them. It allows us to kind of intervene whenever we think is necessary. But I feel like sometimes patients, if they develop a recurrence or if it's persistently positive, understandably want to start doing something like yesterday. And I want to help decrease some of the anxiety, allow them to heal. We can talk about that before we jump into whatever comes next. So can you maybe just talk about timing of radiation and functional status and how you think about this?
So if someone declares themselves early, so the persistently detectable PSA patient, I mean, that's about the only setting where you're thinking about doing radiation therapy within 6 months. One can always start hormonal therapy because typically they're going to be on hormonal therapy if they're really nervous about things and they want to get something done. They want their PSA checked every hour, that type of situation. You can always start the hormonal therapy sooner rather than later. They're going to need that. And starting it in a neoadjuvant concurrent setting is not unreasonable. So if you have that type of situation, they're still not continent yet. They're going to need hormonal therapy down the road anyway. So whether or not they recovered potency, that probably becomes less of an issue. So in that particular setting, persistently detectable PSA level after surgery, someone that's very nervous or concerned about their PSA level, and they aren't willing to say, you know, we're going to wait a little bit until we reassess, add other treatment on, you can always start hormonal therapy. That's unusual these days. As you have intimated, and certainly I follow, it's all about patient preparation. And if you tell the patient ahead of time that, look, even in the setting where you need additional therapy after surgery, we're not going to do it typically for about 6 months. There's always exceptions, but typically for about 6 months, then they're prepared for that. I don't run into the situation very frequently where the patient is saying, well, why don't we radiate yesterday? Usually they've already seen a radiation oncologist pre-decision making, so they have that relationship. They'll be able to contact the radiation oncologist. And as you said, the multi-D clinics, we're all on the same page in terms of timing. We'd like their continence to get as good as possible. And so they're aware of why we're doing things in a particular stepwise fashion. So it's all about preparation. Not to open Pandora's box, but there's this huge debate about whether to call Gleason 6 cancer cancer or not. I think if we prepared patients before their biopsy for what the possibilities are, there would be no debate at all. You could call Gleason 6 whatever you want, cancer, non-cancer, but if you have a conversation with a patient, look, if you are diagnosed with a Gleason 6 prostate cancer on your biopsy, this is something we're going to perform active surveillance on, there wouldn't be a controversy. The controversy is after the fact, people hear the diagnosis of cancer. It's, well, if you've prepped them, then it's not a problem. The problem is on us and not prepping the patients before their biopsy. So anyway, that's a sidelight, but a conversation for another day.
Well, I think that prep is absolutely critical. And, you know, I was preparing for this and I've thought about how, well, let me back up just to complete a thought. So for me, it is a little bit colloquial, but I will tell the patient that typically if we institute radiation, your functional status is going to kind of pause there. So, you know, if you're using a pad and a half a day and we're still seeing some incremental improvement, let's try to wait it out a bit. If you haven't seen the pelvic floor physical therapist, let's get you in to see them to optimize. So generally, I kind of go with that counseling. And even if they're super nervous, help them understand that let's get you potent, let's get you continent so we don't really affect you ultra negatively from a quality of life perspective. Does that all sound okay?
Yeah.
All right.
I follow what you're recommending, yes.
So, you know, historically, and I think it is largely becoming historic because of the types of patients we're treating, going back to prep, when somebody comes in and they have a biochemical recurrence, I love going back to the Charlie Pound paper just to really try to take some of the anxiety out of the room that, listen, and here's what I tell them. If we do nothing, it's going to take 8 years until we pick up a met in all comers. And if we continue to do nothing, another 5 years until you die. And so I say, this is not time to call your family and bring everybody in and get your papers in affair. We need to figure out if doing something at all is actually going to be beneficial to you. So we've got 13 years natural history. And to be quite honest, I feel a little bit paternal saying that now because the type of cancer we're treating are so different. So maybe let me just hear what you think about that and how your first counseling goes with a patient that's had a biochemical recurrence.
Yeah, I think that's the same way. I tell them this is not, you're going to die of prostate cancer within the next 5 years. I said, on the contrary, if you die of prostate cancer within the next 5 years or even 10 years, it'll be quite surprising. So I tell them that this is just an event. It's obviously an event we didn't want to have you experience, but many patients in your situation are still potentially cured, depending upon the individual situation, but salvage radiation therapy cures many patients. And even if that's not curative, again, you're still going to live many, many, many years. So yes, I follow the same paradigm that you discussed. You let them know where they stand. They are likely going to need an additional treatment. The additional treatment is very effective and longevity is expected.
That's perfect. So two questions that I get all the time when there is a biochemical recurrence, and this is clearly a failure of me explaining things, are, where's my PSA coming from? I thought you took my prostate out. And then the second question is, for patients that actually haven't recurred, doc, when can I consider myself cured? When am I kind of good to go? So we can take those one at a time, conditional risk of relapse and prostate cancer. When are you kind of home free? And that obviously will dovetail into how we manage patients that have had a biochemical recurrence. And then also, how do you explain to a patient where their PSA is coming from?
Sure. So I tell a patient that they're going to be monitored for the rest of their lives, that we have had patients who have late recurrence 15, 16, 17 years after radical prostatectomy, and you need to be monitored lifelong. If they've had radiation therapy, it's the same way. You can use the term remission. You can use, we believe you to be cancer-free at the present time. But I think patients have to understand, and I think they like seeing their negative PSAs when they're, you know, I have patients that are 20 years out from their surgery and they still come in religiously once a year just to get their PSA checked to see that it's negative. So I don't tell a patient they're cured, but what I do tell them is that, look, as time goes on, the chances that you experience a biochemical recurrence go down. And those are the data that we've had from long-term studies looking at PSA recurrence. Most of them happen within the first 3 to 5 years. 90-some-odd percent of the patients-ish that are going to experience biochemical recurrence will recur within the 5-year mark. So when they get to 5 years, if they are, you know, their PSA's been undetectable and the like, I don't tell them they're cured, but I tell them the chances that they're going to recur are very, very low. Not zero, but low. So I still do lifelong testing, but cure is a difficult word to say when you've had patients that are 15 years out and all of a sudden their PSA becomes detectable. Now, most of those patients don't need treatment, but still it wigs the patient out and makes them very anxious. But so I don't use the cure word. You have no evidence of disease at the current time. That's great news.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that last comment that you made, and I will add this in, that the further you get out, the likelihood of this being a dangerous, life-threatening recurrence also becomes lesser and lesser. So in terms of where's my PSA coming from, I'll throw this out there. I tell them it's either coming from in the area of the prostate. It could be prostate cancer in the area of the prostate. It could be some benign tissue in the area of the prostate as we're trying to stay super close to the bladder neck and the urethra and the nerves. It could be the nodes. It could be a distant metastasis or any combination. That's my general kind of what's going on. Where's your PSA coming from? Anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, patients. So I tell all the patients that after surgery, we're still going to follow you with a PSA test because a prostate cell anywhere in your body will make PSA. So if your PSA becomes detectable after surgery, it tells us there's prostate tissue somewhere. Now, where the somewhere is, that's the more difficult task. We use imaging, and I tell them about we can detect it at 0.05. We typically don't do imaging until 0.2. So there's a little bit of a gray zone where we're watching things. And the reason we watch things is because there are situations where benign cells have been left behind. And while we can detect the PSA, it typically doesn't continue to increase. It typically levels off and stays at a detectable but relatively low level. We attribute that to benign disease, which is a surgical issue. I left benign cells behind. I shouldn't do that, but I did. But that won't benefit from any type of salvage treatment, meaning you don't need it. We're not going to just treat the PSA test. We want to assess that the PSA is coming from cancer cells, which typically means it continues to increase, and ultimately it usually reaches 0.2 and goes on the paradigm that we talked about. So that's how I explain it. It's very similar to what you said, but patients say, based on my pathology, why don't you just give radiation therapy? And it's for the reason, not all patients with bad pathology recur. And there's no evidence that giving radiation therapy early before a detectable PSA provides any meaningful benefit. So I think that's how I address PSA biochemical recurrence.
Perfect. Perfect. All right. So we've got our patient. They're in the office. They had their PSA drawn a couple of days prior. And for some period of time, it's been undetectable. Now it's detectable. When you're digging into that patient's chart and trying to sort out what comes next, what are the kind of critical elements? Let's say they're functional and all of that. What are the kind of critical elements of their history, physical pathology, et cetera, that to you are the most important drivers here?
Well, pathology, I think, can help. Positive margins are more likely to be a local issue. seminal vesicle invasion can be a local issue, perhaps a little more likely to be metastatic. Obviously, if they had node-positive disease, that suggests node positivity, but it doesn't preclude local recurrence either. So pathology can give a little bit of information. How far they are out from their surgery, 2 years before or after, I mean, that's sort of a general landmark. If they're more than 2 years, more likely local recurrence. If it's before 2 years, more likely distant recurrence. And then imaging. And I don't rely just on one PSA level, of course. We've had several situations where a PSA has been checked, it's been detectable, and then you simply repeat the PSA test and it's gone back to undetectable. And it's just a lab error. I mean, it happens. Always confirm the test, if not just once, twice. I don't necessarily do it immediately. I say, depending upon the value, I usually wait a few weeks and say, look, sometimes there's just these blips and things we don't understand, but we're not going to treat until there's an obvious trend going upwards, and then we will be guided by all the information that we have, pathology reports, time from surgery, what imaging shows.
Yeah, I think these are the kind of tried and true risk factors, grade, margins, nodes, obviously clinical factors, making sure that they've got some gas left in the tank, some years left. Doubling time, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, we typically aren't getting so many PSAs unless it's someone who's rising very slowly, and then you know they have a long doubling time. In terms of, is this a patient who's a candidate for salvage radiation therapy? Should I get 3 to 6 PSA levels so I can calculate a doubling time? I'm not sure that's a practical way of doing things. I think in more advanced disease, sure. But I think in selecting a patient for consideration of salvage radiation, I think the absolute value of the PSA is far more important with other clinical variables than waiting for a doubling time. I might be wrong about that, but that's, I don't use doubling times in terms of, I have a very low threshold to send folks to radiation therapy for the conversation. Even if I'd rather refer too early than too late. And as you have at your place, we have a great relationship with our radiation oncologist. It's not adversarial at all. No one's trying to have the patient and say the other treatment's awful. You shouldn't have surgery. You shouldn't have radiation therapy. It's a group effort. It's multidisciplinary. So I have no trouble sending them off to the radiation oncology folks who will give them very sound advice. It may be a little different advice than I might have given them, but no one's right. It's just different advice. So timing might be a little different, those types of things, but I have a low threshold to just send them to get another opinion.
Totally. I think there historically used to be this thought process that if they see a radiation oncologist, they're going to get radiated. I think that's kind of historical interest only, as long as you have good patient-centric care. I couldn't agree more with that assessment. I also think it's important for patients to really get a firsthand look at, you know, what does radiation look like, number of sessions, bladder filling, time per day, as they're trying to sort this out in the context of their whole life. And for me, I would say that the doubling time really kind of comes into play when I'm trying to talk patients off the ledge who have had a nice long interval, undetectable PSA. It goes from 0.01 undetectable to 0.1, and they're freaking out. And I'm like, so first of all, I kind of go through my, here, you got 13 years, don't freak out. And they want to do something. I'm like, let's just monitor this and we'll check it at 3 months. And if it's barely creeping, well, we're obviously talking about the actual management here. Broad strokes, I'm thinking observation, if they don't have a dangerous cancer, XRT, radiation therapy, monotherapy, or radiation therapy plus ADT, or systemic therapy only. Those are kind of the four buckets I've organized things in. And maybe we can start taking your input on that, starting with observation. Are there people that you're generally saying, yes, your PSA is detectable, but let's just hang tight?
Yeah. I mean, one thing I think that has improved dramatically over the last several years anyway, maybe many years, is radiation therapy. I mean, the side effect profile of salvage radiation therapy has markedly improved. And so the negatives about receiving radiation therapy after surgery are far less than what they were 15 or 20 years ago. So it becomes much easier to recommend a treatment if the side effect profile is fairly bland. So that's why I have a low threshold. In terms of who might I observe following biochemical recurrence, someone with a limited life expectancy, if they're already based on age or medical condition, probably not going to live much longer than 5 years, especially if their PSA is just trickling up and their imaging is negative. I have several of those patients that we're just watching, and they're content with that. That's the main group that I do with observation. The other, there are some patients that are against, they have a bias against receiving radiation therapy for some reason. And if their PSA is not going up very quickly, I'll still have them meet with the radiation oncologist. I'll even have them meet with a medical oncologist, even though they're probably not going to get systemic therapy. But just for a patients like hearing from someone who doesn't have the infamous dog in the fight, so to speak, to give them advice. Medical oncologists aren't selling surgery or selling radiation therapy. And sometimes the medical oncologist can be a good arbiter of what comes next. But there are selected patients, primarily older, less healthy patients, those with shorter life expectancy, patients who are averse to getting salvage anything. They're willing to monitor things. This is where I think you can look at doubling times because you'll have more time to get more PSA values and can get a better calculation of doubling time. Systemic therapy, obviously, if they have metastatic disease on their imaging, and if they have a local disease only or they're being treated as if their local recurrence only and their PSA is a little higher than what we like to see, or they have some other risk factors, I leave that guidance to the radiation oncologist whether or not hormonal therapy is included with prostatic fossa radiation therapy. If there's any kind of, you know, nodal disease or bony disease, other types of metastatic disease, I get the medical oncology folks involved early, not because they're necessarily going to be continuously on hormonal therapy, but again, just to establish the relationship so that if that service is needed down the road, they at least know the person that will be delivering that care.
Yeah, and I think it's going to evolve and maybe become continually more complicated, true multi-D. I mean, taking a walk down memory lane, it used to be like a node positive patient, ADT for the rest of your life, messing trial, boom. Now I would say that that's largely fallen out of favor in a major way. We've got extrapolation from Stampede, ADT, abiraterone radiation. We've got the EMBARK study of enzalutamide. So I think looping in the whole gang, and hopefully they've seen them in some form or fashion for their pre-treatment counseling, makes a lot of sense. And it kind of goes back to nothing, i.e. observation or kitchen sink, radiation, ADT, enza or abi, fossa plus nodes potentially are the gamut as I see it today. Is that fair?
I think that's incredibly accurate. And yes, we're getting better at detecting systemic disease, and we're getting better at determining what therapies are useful in a particular systemic disease. So I think, yeah, it's not all or none anymore. It's not we're going to do nothing versus we're going to do everything. I think we're going to be, and this will happen as time goes on, I think we'll be better able to select what type of therapy is most appropriate for a given type of patient. That'll involve genetics, that will involve targeted therapies, and as is the trend now, I'm not saying anything that's mind-boggling by any means, is we're going to, as we're doing, shift away from treating cancer by their cell of origin, but by their genetic makeup. So we won't treat prostate cancer, we won't treat bladder cancer, we won't treat kidney cancer. We'll treat a cancer of this type of genetic makeup is managed with this approach. You know, and it may only be in the classic sense, well, that's only 5% of prostate cancers. And you'll say, well, that's great because in these patients, this drug works wonderful. You know, it's like olaparib. It's, you know, the PARP inhibitors. It's a very small percentage of patients that will benefit, but there is a benefit. So I think surgery will probably be used more. And not necessarily, as they call it, debulking. It's not just taking out or treating the primary, perhaps with both surgery and radiation therapy. using appropriate systemic therapy guided by genetics, the clinical situation, et cetera. But I think surgery is not going to go away. I think it's going to be a critical part of a multi-D management to try to cure patients with metastatic disease. That's the goal. And I think surgery will play a key role in that.
Well, I couldn't have asked for a better plug. You all have a neoadjuvant PARP inhibitor trial, olaparib in high-risk patients with BRCA mutations. Yes, the incidence is only 5%, but you better believe it, for those 5%, it could be a total game changer. So I totally love that. And of course, you spearheaded the CalGB trial of neoadjuvant docetaxel. And I think we had to keep looking, and there's going to be the subsets that benefit. Since you kind of mentioned personalized medicine, tailored medicine, are you using any genomic classifiers to help inform timing of radiation, PSA levels, and whether or not to use ADT as well, like Decipher, for instance?
Yeah, certainly from the standpoint, primarily an unfavorable intermediate risk, the 4+3s, typically they will get a Decipher test to help guide whether or not the patient will or won't benefit from the addition of ADT. Haven't used it much post-radical to say a patient should or should not receive early radiation therapy. I still use PSA testing and let that guide me. And I have not used the Decipher testing post-radical to say, oh, your PSA is just detectable, we're going to give you radiation therapy early rather than waiting to 0.2. I don't know if I'm right or wrong in that. I just don't think the data is convincing enough to say that particular use of genetic testing alters what I'm going to do with the patient. Where I think patients certainly, and some physicians, we use the term genetic testing. And there's so many different, there's germline testing, there's somatic testing, there's these specific, you mentioned Decipher, Oncotype, Prolaris, they all measure different things. And I think that we have to be very clear when we say, oh, we're going to get a genetic test. Well, what genetic test, why are you getting it, and what's the purpose of it? So what I try to teach the fellows, if you're going to order a test, is it going to change your management, even if it's a hemoglobin? Why do you get a hemoglobin at 8 hours? The guy's hemodynamically stable. You had one 4 hours ago, and it's normal. I mean, why are you getting it? What are you going to do with that test? If it goes down, what are you going to do with it? If it goes up, what are you going to do with it? Why are you doing the test? So we have to have a reason to do the test. I mean, there's so many tests we have available today. It's why are you doing it, and how are you going to react to the result? If it's not going to change management, don't do the test. So I don't routinely, all my low-risk patients, I don't get genetic testing on them. Just the ones that are sort of borderline. And even those patients, I'm really trying to convince them to have active surveillance, but I many times will get a genetic test if they're saying, you know, I want treatment, hoping the genetic test comes back favorable, so it gives me more reason to help them make a shared decision about choosing active surveillance.
I absolutely appreciate that. And it's going to remain a dynamic process. And the way I see it is we just need to stay up to date. There used to be the Stevenson paper where the holy grail magic number was 0.5. Then there was the update, it was 0.2 to kind of pull the trigger, so to speak. And I think there's evolution in the management to get like node positive ADT for everybody. Now it's another way of thinking that, as you described earlier.
But that's the exciting part of it. If everything stayed the same, it would get boring.
Absolutely.
I mean, heck, we're operating on seminoma now. My God.
There you go.
You know, so.
And it is exciting. So we talked about observation. We talked about maybe the other end of the spectrum, the grade groups, fours, fives, high PSAs, persistently positive, that are going to be more EMBARK, ABI, ADT, plus radiation land. ADT, intermittent ADT, is that something that you're doing much in your practice?
So I have to punt because Memorial is a different place. I've not given ADT for the whole time I've been here. And the reason for that is a bit historical, but back in the day, giving ADT may have made patients ineligible for clinical trials. So the agreement at Memorial was that if someone had a biochemical recurrence after surgery or radiation therapy, we would not give ADT and have the medical oncologist evaluate the patient, and that is perpetuated. So I have to back off a little bit in terms of whom I recommend radiation or hormonal therapy for, because I don't give it. I know our medical oncologists use intermittent hormonal therapy in some situations. They use continuous in some situations. So it just depends. But I punt to the experts on systemic therapy. I don't give it.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I mean, I personally think that even this clinical stage is getting increasingly complex. There's opportunity for clinical trials. There's opportunities for escalation, enzalutamide, abiraterone, et cetera. And perhaps in the community setting, a large urology group practice setting where there's not the support infrastructure to really run through everything, it makes sense for a urologist to say, hey, let me prescribe your ADT and your enzalutamide, which isn't rocket science, and we'll get you well taken care of. But I would tend to agree that's a patient in my hands that I want to loop in the team to make sure we're doing it perfectly. The baseline DEXA scans, the vitamin D, the calcium, all of it. It's not just, here's your ADT, have a good time.
Right. Yeah, I think there's many urologists who do that. It's just, I'm not one of them. And I realize my limitations, and I do have the benefit of having folks around me who are interested and do it a lot better than I do. I mean, my bar for referral is very low. As you mentioned, there are some practices where there are urologists who focus on systemic therapy, and they're great at it. And I think as long as one is comfortable doing all the things that you mentioned, pre-evaluation, you know, DEXA scans, making sure patients get their vitamin D and calcium and do exercise, especially weight-bearing exercise, that they take their medications appropriately, they're monitored appropriately, then have at it. I mean, I don't care if a urologist is giving the right treatment or a medical oncologist is giving the right treatment, as long as it's the right treatment. It's just, I'm not the urologist that does that. And I'm not comfortable doing it, so I refer. If there is a urologist that's comfortable doing it, great. That's fine. The patient just needs a good doctor. It doesn't matter what their moniker is.
Yeah, I love that. And I think the lifestyle elements of it, the diet, the exercise, the health, that's clearly outside of MRT purview. I think it's incredibly important because it empowers patients to do something as things are being done to them. So I couldn't agree more that this is becoming a team sport more so than it even was once upon a time. Well, James, I've certainly learned a ton as we approach an hour here. You know, as we're kind of wrapping up, any kind of parting thoughts for the listenership on this topic or prostate cancer or in general?
I think that patients are getting more sophisticated. And as we talked about on several fronts, I mentioned, you know, before a biopsy, talking about what the possible outcomes of the biopsy are so that a Gleason 6 doesn't become this monumental Twitter X argument, talking about biochemical recurrence ahead of time. The prepared patient is the best patient, and best, I mean, from their overall own well-being. They've heard it before. It's not a surprise. They're potentially prepared for it. And it takes a lot less time doing it up front than trying to explain it after the fact. We would never operate on someone and not tell them that incontinence is a risk factor after radical prostatectomy. So the same thing. Biochemical recurrence is a risk factor after radical prostatectomy, but as you mentioned, it doesn't mean a death sentence. There's lots of ways to treat that. We're going to have to monitor you. So all of those things, prepping patients for what the potential outcomes are, it takes a few minutes. It's time well spent, and you'll have a much happier patient population.
I love it. I love it. Well, it's wonderful to connect again. Thank you for all of your insight, and looking forward to connecting here in April for the Valentine Lecture.
Yeah, it'll be great to see you in person, and I look forward to hosting you as part of the New York section.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend.
If you have any questions or comments, DM us at _backtable on Instagram, LinkedIn, or Twitter.
Backtable is hosted by Aditya Bagrodia
and Jose Silva.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles, Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Chi Deng.
Administrative support provided by Jim Lee Kinnebrew.
Thanks again for listening, and see you next week.